This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, the sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Ocean.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to our customary Wednesday evening feature here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, the show trainers listen to. And we do welcome everybody joining us across the country right now on Sirius Channel 93. For everybody who has been with us over the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 209, welcome back to the program. And of course, for everyone tuning in worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net, we do welcome you here tonight as well. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick Four, our producer Lee Delapina, and we are set for another exciting edition of Trainer Talk. And JT, each and every week, you and I, well, we go on and on about the fact that we have the opportunity to talk to so many great people on this show and so many of the biggest names in our sport and give people a different perspective on what these trainers are all about and really just show people, hey, trainers are people too. And I think a lot of fans don't realize that.
Yeah, well, you know, the hype around trainers is a good thing for our sport, but a lot of times people don't put the name with the face. They see the names all the time and they can quote the stats and all that, but they don't know anything about the actual person. And that's one of the beauties of this show, and it's one of the most fun things that we do is have the trainers on and talk to them about their careers and how they got into the game and you know, what their philosophies are, that kind of thing. And it's really insightful. It's been tremendous for us.
Well, the man who quite often is referred to simply as Donnie K. Von Hemel, is going to be with us in the first half of the program. Chuck Simon will be with us in the second half, and we'll hear each of their stories over the course of the next hour here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. And Donnie, without further ado, joins us now, the 51-year-old native of Mantor, Kansas, closing in on yet another milestone in an already stellar career. He sits just 49 wins shy of 2,000 at 1951, and his runners have earned more than $48 million in purses, and no doubt that his 2011 Breeders' Cup mile winner Caleb's Posse did his part to bolster that number. Donnie K with us now, and Donnie, thanks and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a unique opportunity here.
Well, you know, when I recap those numbers at the beginning of the show, most trainers have no idea where they stand. Did you realize that you were in that category with the number of wins and the number of purse earnings, or did that catch you a little bit by surprise?
With technology today, it's hard not to know. And as far as the 2,000 wins, I wish they wouldn't even bring that up till it was about 2002, you know, a couple past there, because it seems like anytime anybody gets close to one of those numbers that you struggle for a while to get there.
Yeah, why is that? Why does a barn go cold right at the cusp of the milestone win? It's ridiculous. Yeah.
I think barns go hot and cold anyway, and it just brings more attention to when you're cold.
Yeah.
Are you already starting to feel the pressure?
Excuse me?
Are you already starting to feel the pressure?
No, not at all. We've got a lot of good clients, and it's more about each horse and what they're doing and what you're trying to accomplish with each horse and any kind of career numbers. Those are just something that happens along the way.
Donnie K. Von Hemel, our special guest on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Donnie, when you mentioned the name Von Hemel in the sport of thoroughbred racing, it is synonymous with success and in many instances with greatness. Your dad, a longtime trainer in the Midwest, he's a member of the Nebraska Hall of Fame. He's had several accolades, bestowed upon him throughout his career, more than 2,400 career victories to his credit. Take us back to the beginning. This is something that was certainly in your pedigree from the very start.
Yeah, I grew up, my father was a trainer while I was growing up, and his father was a farmer rancher out in Kansas and broke horses. I mean, one of my earliest memories, or one of my father's earliest memories is when he was a young boy that his father would ride a horse home from the main ranch to where they were living, a green broke colt, and then the next morning his mother, my grandmother, trying to get him back up on that green broke two-year-old so he could ride it back to the ranch. It would have been probably in during the Depression, and out in western Kansas, a lot of dust flying around, and you know, think back to that kind of stuff, and the chance that my father had growing up on a farm and ranch, and the man that owned the place had horses, had thoroughbred race horses. The odds of all that coming together are probably pretty long, but he started out young and became a trainer under Speck Lane, who was training the horses at that time for W.D. Rourke from Manor, Kansas also, and then, you know, kind of got his start under Speck Lane, and then got out on his own in the late 50s, and has just, I'm just so proud of my father and what he's done and the opportunities he's given me.
Well, that's quite a picture you painted, your grandmother trying to give your grandfather a leg up. I can just picture a lady in her apron out there with the dust flying and in her long skirt and trying to get a cowboy up in the saddle on some crazy horse. It's just fantastic. But you know, your dad, obviously a tremendous influence on your career and on your life, certainly. And talk about some of the first memories you have of successes that your dad had.
Oh yeah, that was as we're growing up and going to school and always, you know, when you're in a racing family, that's pretty much envelops the whole family all the time. And I remember days at Denver Old Centennial Racetrack in Denver when my father was the leading trainer there and had beaten out Lyman Rollins for the first time in a long time that anybody had beaten Lyman Rollins out there for the trainer's title, and him winning four races out of four starts in a day and just really a great time as a kid growing up. Now, we got to go in the summertime where he was racing. Now, in the wintertime, we always went back home to Kansas and went to school all the time in one school, and that was I think a very good thing. But going to Omaha and Denver in the summer, when you're from western Kansas and you get to go to a place like Omaha or Denver for the summer, that's a big deal. I always remember him having some nice horses and for some people out Sam Britt out in New Mexico was one of the first guys that really gave him a chance with some horses of his own when he went out as a public trainer, which would have been in the 60s then, and had a filly named Mighty Classy who won a bunch of races for my father and Mr. Britt, and back then the fillies in that part of the country, you ran with the boys too, and she beat boys, fillies, colts, whatever you entered her with. She was a really nice filly. This is probably one of the first ones that I remember, a nice horse my father had, and then just all the people that he trained for, you know, just a lot of good people and that enjoyed the sport and wanted to have fun doing it, and it was a great thing. And he would, at that time, he would come home in the winter times and break colts. So we got to be around that when he was home in the wintertime and turn the older horses out and break the colts. And now racing has evolved now where you pretty much year round that you don't get to do that in the thoroughbred business anymore. But that was a great thing to be around too, and a learning experience as you grew up.
You mentioned Sam Britt, who's partners with my client, Michael House. They just won the division of the Del Mar Derby with Gabriel Charles. And Mr. Britt, I think he's pretty up there in age, but he really loves the game. And your dad obviously did a great job breaking him in as a client. One of his favorite quotes is, no risk it, no biscuit. And he's a wild man. Even to this day, he loves the action.
Oh yeah, yeah. When they come to watch one of their horses run, they were ready to back him financially at the windows.
That's right.
Well, Donnie, I had read somewhere that you were quoted as saying that you always wanted to be a horse trainer, even though you went to school at Fort Hays State University to get your accounting degree. But even going through school, you always knew that, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to be a horse trainer.
Yeah, when you grow up around it, it's hard to really get away from it, and all the trappings of it, I guess. And luckily, when I did graduate, my father, he said, "Well, are you still interested in the horses?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I'll help you get going." And really, growing up as a teenager, hanging around the barn and walking hots and rubbing horses and learning, you learn a lot of stuff just from grooms and gallop boys. You just got to be around and pay attention. And then, of course, watching the way my father handled his horses and his crew and his clients, I think that's no doubt the biggest influence on myself. Like I said, I thank him and all the people that worked for him while I was growing up and learning the game, that you learn from everybody.
And Donnie, if I'm not mistaken, it's the Fort Hays State Tigers. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, Victor E. Tiger. I looked that up. It's the mascot for Fort Hays State University. What is the best advice that your dad ever gave to you when you told him, hey, I want to do this full time. This is what I want to be.
Well, just that if you're going to do it, do it to the best of your ability and be willing to put the time and the effort in to be successful. I don't think it's not a 40-hour week for anybody that works around horses. If you're not willing to put in a lot of time and effort, then you're probably in the wrong game. But, I think that's the best thing he told me was, if you're going to do it the best you can and be willing to put in the time and effort to get to where you want to be.
Well, it is a lifestyle. It's certainly really not a profession. It's really not a job. It's a way of living, and you got to be willing to get up early, stay late, and then in the meantime, talk to your clients on the phone when you have 5 minutes. I mean, it's a miracle that you even have time to take a shower sometimes. It's a very difficult life, but it can be so rewarding. And you had a little bit of an edge, I think, going into it, growing up in that atmosphere. I mean, that was just the way you did things. So it wasn't like culture shock or anything to you. It was just the way you were.
Exactly. And, new people trying to read the racing form a lot. I don't ever remember not being able to read the racing form. It was always around and everybody knew how to read it. And I was also lucky. My wife, Robin, I met her on the racetrack. So it wasn't a cultural shock to her either, what it took to be around the horses and the hours and the travel and stuff. So I think that was probably important. I can't imagine marrying someone from the outside world.
Yeah.
And then expecting them to understand the racing and what it takes.
Yeah, so many marriages on the racetrack don't last very long, because when you do marry someone from the outside world, as you said, and it really is like that. I mean, it's like they're from a different planet, you know. Us in racing, we're the ones that are from the different planet. I mean, people don't understand that you don't work 5 days a week and you don't have Saturdays off, and you're missing a lot of your kids' ball games and all of that stuff that the regular dads get to do or the regular moms get to do. But it's such an advantage to have somebody that understands the game in your life and realizes the sacrifices and is willing to put up with that.
Yeah. I, like I said, I think that's a very important thing if you're going to have a successful marriage and be in racing. I certainly do.
Talking with Donnie K. Von Hemel here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Donnie, I guess it was early to mid-80s, when you first took out your trainer's license, went out on your own. What year was it exactly, and what do you remember about those first couple of years?
Oh, I remember it was probably about 84, I'm thinking. Anyway, somewhere like says early to mid-80s, and really was given an opportunity. My father, he'd want to send a few horses somewhere, and rather than, put them in his name and him being the trainer, he just said, well, take these horses to Louisiana Downs this summer, and you'll be down as a trainer. And it's just a way of getting your name out there. And then once you win a few races and you start talking to some people, and then having a nice horse or two along the way to show people that you can do the job, those are all things that were advantages that I had, and just tried to make the most of them when the opportunities came.
Who was your first really big horse that kind of put you on the map?
I would probably say Explosive Girl. She won almost $500,000 and won some big races in Omaha at Exarvin, the old Exarvin racetrack. And as a three-year-old, she beat a horse Lucas shipped in for a stake race. An older, I think she'd been champion three-year-old filly maybe the year before. But anyway, a real nice horse that Lucas shipped in for, it was at the time the Exarvin Budweiser Breeders' Cup. And she was a three-year-old filly, and she beat older mares that day. Her purse was $150,000. And it was the really first really big race that I'd won. And a lot of thanks goes out to Explosive Girl for helping me on up the ladder.
You know, you can certainly compete with your horses all over the country and on the biggest of stages, Donnie, but when you look back at the majority of your success, it's come in the Midwest. You're the all-time leading trainer by number of wins in Remington Park history. Some people would say, well, he's a big fish in a small pond. Are you happy with that? Do you like that description, being a big fish in a small pond?
Well, I don't know how apt the description is. I mean, I've won more races and more money away from Remington than I have at it's certainly a place that it opened in 1988 in a time when my career was starting to grow, and it was an opportunity at a new racetrack and to develop some new clients actually made my home there since 1988, and have been real happy. When we have horses that can travel and win in other places, we can do that. We've done that several times over the past 30 years. And at the same time, I think you do have a chance with a young horse that's maybe not the best horse to get him in some races where he can compete and be successful and become a better horse, because he knows what his job is. He's been out there, and he can win a race or two, and once he knows what he's doing, he can become a better horse without getting beat up so many times at the bigger tracks, at the bigger purses. A lot of horses that would have would have turned out better just get beat up so much they just don't become the horses they can be, I don't think.
Yes, spotting them around is the key, and you're noted for individualized attention to your horses. Talk about that and how you keep track of your far-flung operation.
Well, I tell you, we've got a very good crew. Efren Chavez and Crystal Campbell are two assistants I have, and they're very key in that. I try to stay in one place whenever possible. Every once in a while, we'll have a smaller division somewhere else, but try to keep it around 40 or 45 horses in one spot, and that seems to be the best number. And that's most tracks. That's kind of what they'll let you have on the grounds, and have, like I said, a good staff helping me, and just trying to be around the horses as much as you can, and being out on the racetrack every day and watching them, and just something simple as watching one cool out one day. You might see something that you wouldn't have seen otherwise if you weren't there.
Yeah, Donnie, so many times in the sport we hear trainers described as being not just a trainer, but a really, really good horseman. What does that mean to hear yourself described like that? Because I know a lot of people talk about you in that light.
Well, in my mind, that's the best compliment that you can be paid in this business, is that you're a horseman, because that means that you put the horses first and you have a knowledge and a connection with horses, and like I said, to me that's the highest compliment you can pay to a trainer, is that he's a horseman.
So you talked about being on the map with some of the big horses you trained earlier in your career, and then along comes, you know, Clever Trevor and Mariah Storm and Evansville Slough, and then here comes Kayla's Posse in 2010, and that really took things to a whole new level. Talk about the big horse for a few minutes.
Oh, it was great fun, I can say that. And a bit of a learning experience finding the right spot for him. We had some nice races as a two-year-old, and then early in his three-year-old year, he showed that he was a quality three-year-old too. And it was probably, alternation was probably the reason I went to Saratoga when he was three, and decided to take some other horses up there with us, and Caleb was one of them, and turns out, and decided at that point that probably sprinting was going to be the best thing for him, and got him up to Saratoga, and of course from there it was just like, well, he won this race, we got to try the King's Bishop next. And then, well, he won the King's Bishop, we probably need to look toward the Breeders' Cup. So it was just one of those things where it was great fun. And, of course, winning the Breeders' Cup was probably the racing thrill, biggest thrill of racing that I've had. And then the three races he ran as a four-year-old were probably... that year, I don't know if a horse ran three better races in a row than he did, but he ran second in all three of them. And he would come back and beat the horse that would beat him in the photo. He'd beat him the next time. But just really came to run every time. Really, really nice horse.
Yeah, he really developed kind of a cult following, with his performances. And a lot of fans were very passionate about Caleb's Posse. A lot more than you would think for a horse that was, basically a middle distance horse.
I think, yeah. And it was probably unique that the three-year-old ranks that year were, there wasn't any one dominant horse. Nobody won more than one Triple Crown race or more than a couple of grade ones for the whole year. So it probably spread things out and made it an opportunity for us to be at the Eclipse Awards as a finalist and get beat out by a couple of votes by Animal Kingdom. It was, as a trainer, one of the things I always want to do is train a champion, and we were really close, really close that that time, and now we're out here trying to get another one to that point.
Well, Donnie, we started off tonight talking about your dad and his success, and of course your brother Kelly, also a trainer. When you get together around the holidays and you have a chance to sit down and have dinner together, are the conversations all about horse racing, or are there other topics that the Von Hemels are into?
No, we're a little more diverse than that. The horses will come up, but of course, at that time of year, college football is going pretty hard, and we're all trying to decipher that and have fun and enjoy doing that. And of course, I've got a daughter that's a freshman in high school now, and she rides hunter jumpers, and you know, we'll get grandma and grandpa over there to watch her ride sometime during the holidays, just have good family time in there while you're racing, trying to fit those things in. But fortunately, Remington gets over in the middle of December, and then Oaklawn doesn't start till about the 10th of January. So you do have a few days in there when you can get the holiday stuff in.
Where do those college football allegiances lie?
Well, I would say for myself, Big 12 in general, because I've lived and raced pretty much all over that area. And so I'm a Big 12 fan. Nobody in particular in the Big 12. Of course, we live in Oklahoma, and so we get a little more coverage and interest in those teams there. My brother, of course, he's been a Nebraska fan for a long time, and they went over to the Big Ten, so we give him a hard time about that all the time.
Well, Donnie, we can't thank you enough for being here on Trainer Talk with us tonight. It's been a lot of fun to hear your story. We want to wish you all the best in your quest for that next milestone. We won't mention it out loud, but that next milestone coming up on the horizon. And thanks so much for being here. We'll get you your gifts for appearing on the show. All of our guests who appear live on Trainer Talk receive gifts from EPO Equine, our man Joey Diamond. He will take care of you on that front, and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll get those to you.
Oh, well, thank you. I enjoyed talking with you guys, and hope you have a good evening.
All right, Donnie K. Von Hemel here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. And cool. Again, we just go, wow.
Yeah, great story. Good fella.
And looking forward to our story coming up in the second half as well. More Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton is ahead. Chuck Simon, our special guest in the second half of the show. Stay tuned here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Fasig Tipton welcomes nominations now for the November sale, the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. 15 horses in 2012 sold for $1 million and higher, more than any other mixed sale in the world. Exceptional weanling market, with foals selling for up to $620,000. Horse of the Year Havre de Grace sold for $10 million, the world's highest priced auction thoroughbred of 2012. The November sale at Fasig Tipton in Kentucky. Nominate now.
Now you can help your equine athlete heal faster and recover stronger with Ultras Elite, a wearable low-intensity therapeutic ultrasound system that has been used successfully to treat splints, suspensory ligament and tendon injuries, muscle strains, stiff joints, and bone fractures. Ultras Elite is clinically proven to reduce swelling and inflammation, increase joint flexibility, and reduce pain and irritation. For more information, visit ultras.com. Ultras, heal faster, recover stronger.
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, makers of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, here in North America, horsemen are protecting their horses with Flair strips. Are the strips benefiting horses in other parts of the world?
Mike, horsemen around the world use the strips to protect lung health. For example, South African horse at the Euro Variety Club regularly races with a strip. In South Africa, many graded stakes, including grade 1 stakes, have been won in 2013 by horses wearing the strips. In New Zealand, reigning horse at the Euro Mufasa races with a strip, as well as many thoroughbred and standardbred stakes winners in Singapore and Australasia this season.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to racehorsereport.com. Make racehorsereport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
Racehorsereport.com.
The 2013 Daily Racing Form National Handicapping Championship Tour is off and running with tournaments virtually every week. Last year's NHC and Tour had total prize money of nearly $1.8 million. Jim Bennis, a horse player from Chicago, Illinois, landed the grand prize of $750,000, an Eclipse Award, and the title Handicapper of the Year. Find out more by visiting nhctour.com and join the tour today to begin your quest for the NHC in January 2014 in Las Vegas.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Basic Tipton.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Basic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Jute Feld, an enjoyable visit with Donnie Kay von Hemel in the first half of the program, and looking forward to talking with Chuck Simon here in the second half and hearing his story. But we do want to remind you first that the Phasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale is coming up quickly on September 30th. Circle that date in your calendar. 390 yearlings by 157 different sires have been cataloged, and this is a sale that has quite often produced outstanding runners. They've really become known for that. Grade 1 Spinaway winner So Many Ways, Grade 2 Delaware Oaks winner Dancing a Fleet, and Grade 2 Brooklyn Handicap winner Redeemed, all graduates of that Phasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale. Again, September 30th, circle it on your calendar and be there to check that one out. JT, always an outstanding sale.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice horses have gone through that sale, and it's one you don't want to miss. Plus, you get to spend some time in a beautiful location.
Yeah, always beautiful up there. And speaking of outstanding, our next guest, Chuck Simon, with us now, the 46-year-old native of Albany, New York. Growing up in Saratoga Springs, he has trained more than 300 winners, nearly $10 million in purse earnings. And he is with us now here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Chuck, nice to talk to you, my friend.
Hey, guys. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I mentioned growing up in Albany, well, growing up in Saratoga after being born in Albany, not hard to get hooked on horse racing when you grow up in Saratoga, is it?
No, it's not. And back then the world was actually seemingly a bigger place, and the internet and all the things we have now have kind of brought a lot of things, you know, closer. But we in Saratoga, you know, we're kids. We didn't know that every town didn't have grade one races and the Travers and big trainers and jockeys. And we just kind of assumed that this was how it was. And we really didn't realize how fortunate we were to be able to grow up and be exposed to all the great horses and great races every summer. It just was just part of life living there. But now you look back and you realize, you know, what great opportunity it was to be able to be exposed to that, on a yearly basis.
Well, you know, as you know, I grew up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which is only about an hour east of Saratoga or so, south and east. And I grew up going to the races at Saratoga, cutting my teeth on racing at that historic track. I can remember kind of lining up to get in as a kid and running to get a picnic table at the top of the stretch because we couldn't afford grandstand seats at that time, because that was a couple more dollars that we wouldn't have had to bet with. Do you have a similar story about going to the races there for the first couple of times?
Oh, sure. I mean, I was going there, you know, before I even remember. But I think probably my first job in life was me and my brothers would be squatters. We'd run around and get tickets and bring them home, and we'd always find, you know, discarded winners or late scratches or things like that. And we always made enough money to go buy candy or whatever it was we were interested in. And that's actually back, fortunately, I'm old enough to remember when they had different colored tickets for different colored wagers there. I think the black ones, the black tickets, the black and whites were $50 wagers, and the greens were $20, reds were fives, and orange were two. I still have some of those little tickets somewhere, but, you know, not like the generic ones that we see now, but, yeah, you know, growing up there is, and in Saratoga, I guess, you know, it's hard to have, you know, you see things differently as an adult than you do as a kid, but, you know, certainly it's a bigger deal now than it was back then. Well, it's a lot longer for one, but, I remember being there a lot of weekdays, where there was really not that many people. It was, the grandstand was pretty empty. There was always crowds on the weekends, but, I don't think that Saratoga quite had the reputation and the cachet, kind of, so to speak, that it has now, where it's such a big deal, and it's a big deal in, you know, not only in horse racing but in that Capital District area, like you said, you know, growing up locally, everybody from the surrounding areas, that's, you know, one of the keys to the summer. They look forward to planning days and having events there, and, you know, the people meet out in the backyards and have cookouts and all kinds of things. But it was we're very fortunate to have grown up in a great place like Saratoga.
What was the biggest score you and your brother ever made on those tickets that you were picking up? Do you remember?
I think we made like $128 one day. we weren't only you know, doing this Saratoga. Every time we would go on a family vacation, say the Jersey Shore, we would do this at Monmouth and Atlantic City. I believe they wouldn't let us in Atlantic City. We were stuck outside. That's when the law didn't allow anyone under 18 or 21 in the grandstand. But I think at Monmouth one day we made a score of a couple hundred dollars. Someone had thrown away a winning daily double ticket. It was worth money. But it was, you know, kept us busy, that's for sure. But it was a good time, and you know, the racetrack for us was always kind of a normal place. It wasn't a foreign place at all, like it is to a lot of, you know, kids who aren't exposed, you know, whose parents aren't you know, fans or are not involved in the industry. They, you know, the racetrack can be a bit of a daunting place. You know, you look at the form and it's a little bit complicated and you know, just the whole process, but you know, when you do it from you know, basically childhood, it's just another place, and that's always kind of how we looked at it. And I think a lot of people that grew up in Saratoga and people grew up in places like Lexington, you know, you view the business that way because it's something that they were exposed to at a young age, and it was a part of the deal, more or less. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't foreign to them, as it is, unfortunately, to so many other people in areas that aren't served by racetracks or where racing just isn't that popular.
Yeah, there's no question. I grew up in the shadow of Santa Anita, and you know, used to go out to the races with my brother a lot like you, and it's like it's always been there, you know. It's just part of life in that particular area, and everybody talks about the races. And of course, Saratoga is such a cool place anyway. I mean, just nice year round. I mean, I'm sure, you know, the cold and stuff gets a little old, but you always have that feeling the horses are coming back. It's going to be, you know, great when summer gets here. It's a very unique feeling that I think, it is unfortunate that a lot of people miss that.
Yeah. I agree. And, you know, Saratoga, for instance, just the town surrounding it has grown so much over the last,
probably just 10, 15 years. There's so many people have moved. You know, they've gone there and fallen in love with the area. And like I said, the cold in the winter is not so great, but it's just a really great area because there's, you know, the lake is right, you know, a couple miles down the road, and you know, the downtown area has expanded, and you know, you see condos going up all over the place, and it's you know, going from a sleepy little town to a thriving town. You know, they have now, of course, the harness track has the Racino, and that attracts a lot of people. But it's an interesting place, you know, just a really unique place in the whole country.
Yeah, and Chuck, I'm glad you brought up the harness track too, because if I'm not mistaken, your start in the business came with standardbreds at the standardbred track, not with the thoroughbreds. Is that right?
No, that's true. My dad got me a job, I think I was 15, at a local standardbred track. It was not far from where we lived. They were standing the famous sire Niatros. He was going to go stand stud there, and I thought I was getting a job working at a horse farm, working with horses. And first day I got there, they gave me a shovel and a wheelbarrow, and they directed me to this giant 40-acre field, and they said, "Go pick all the rocks out of the field." So I did that for 2 days, and then decided that slave labor wasn't really what I was looking for. And I rode my scooter over to the harness track and snuck in the maintenance gate, and found myself a job cleaning stalls, and got started that way.
How old were you then?
You know, things come full circle. Is Sheree DeVoe, who's Chad Brown's assistant in New York. I saw Chad give her a lot of credit the other day for her work with the filly that won the grade one there this weekend. My first job was working for her dad at the harness track. He's a harness trainer, still trains up there. And, you know, that's funny how it works. And she wound up coming to work for me about 10 years ago at Saratoga. And, you know, it's a small world, I guess. But, you know, standardbreds, they're tough horses. And I still follow it a little bit. I went up to the Hambletonian, and I actually wound up, after graduating from college, worked at Yonkers as assistant racing secretary for 2 years. I was still trying to, you know, kind of figure out what it was I wanted to do before I decided, you know, to go into training part full time. And it was a good education with a lot of work, that's for sure. I think I was wound up by the end of the summer taking care of 8 horses a week. And I think I got about $40 and free lunch every day. you know, it was fun, and it was a whole lot better than working at McDonald's or doing something, you know, horrible like that.
And how old were you when you started working with the standardbreds?
I think I was 15. I was still too young to work on the track, even with permission from your parents. And what I used to do is I had a little moped, and I'd go over to the maintenance gate, because the maintenance gate wasn't locked. It was just, they had a double end snap that kept it closed, and those maintenance guys never showed up before 7 o'clock. So I would just make sure I got there before 7 o'clock, and I'd sneak through the maintenance gate and just go on with my business. And I was always tall and I was big, so, you know, I didn't look young, but, I kind of, you know, snuck in and went to work. And once you're inside, obviously everything's fine and people get used to seeing you, and I never had any problems after that.
Yeah, they build the fences to keep the people in.
So what was your big break on the thoroughbred side of things? When did you finally decide, hey, I want to be a trainer, and who helped you get there?
Well, you know, I was working, as I said, at Yonkers in the racing office, and it just wasn't what I wanted to do. And yeah, I appreciated the opportunity, and there weren't many 21-year-old, you know, racing secretaries out there. But it was a grind, and it's night racing, and you know, you're drawing in the morning, you're racing at night, and there at the time we were going 7 days a week in the summer, and briefly we actually were racing 8 cards, racing when Naira was
was going 6 days a week. Yonkers was going seven nights and twice on Tuesdays. And I missed, you know, being around the horses and that side of the business. And I just decided one day to go over to Belmont and kind of start anew, try something, you know, different. I had saved a little bit of money and I went over to Wayne Lucas's barn because I'd known Todd Fletcher from our time at the University of Arizona together, and Todd actually wasn't there. George Weaver was there. Jeff Lucas was the assistant, and I said, you got a job for me? He said, well, no, not really, but, you know. And Jeff said, you know, what can you do? And he said, well, I know how to groom horses and stuff like that. And he said, well, just, you know, we'll give him a job. And that's kind of how I got back in, was working for those guys over at Belmont for a little bit. And I bounced around from place to place. And I worked for Tommy Skiffington, who was a very good trainer. He was an excellent horse, and I learned a lot from Tommy. I worked for him for a while. I worked for Pete Ferriola over at Aqueduct for a while, and he was the leading trainer in New York, you know, big claiming outfit. And I worked briefly for Nick Zito for a spring in Kentucky at Keeneland. And then my biggest break probably was when the job for Alan Jerkins came open. And the guys who worked for Alan had been there for years and years and years. And one had just retired, and the other assistant kind of got himself in a little bit of a legal jam, and a spot opened up, and I liked working for Nick, but this was a unique opportunity to get, you know, in with Alan, who, you know, was growing up in New York, you always kind of revered him, and Jimmy was the assistant, their main assistant at the time, and, you know, Jimmy was a good guy, got along good with him, and I jumped at the opportunity, and I wound up working for Alan for about six and a half years. And the funny thing was, I thought I knew a lot about horses when I worked for Alan, and after about 3 days, I figured that, found out that I knew virtually nothing, because he was just an unbelievable horseman and an unbelievable person, too. I mean, he's a great person. The things, the people he's helped and the things he's done, with very little fanfare, and he wouldn't even want you to talk about it, but his approach was so much different than everyone else's, and it's not that it's a right or a wrong thing, it's just different. His way of looking at horses, things he paid attention to, it was just kind of a unique, I'm so glad that I was able to do that, because it helped me as a horseman immensely. And one of the things that he really does, everybody says, oh, we treat them all like individuals, and then, you know, pretty much they feed them all the same and they train them all the same. But he really does. He tries to figure a horse out and field train them, you know, in almost radical ways. And he would do things like if he didn't like the way the horse walked out to the track, he just wouldn't train him that day. He'd change his mind and about things. It was really a style of training that I don't know that anyone else really has. And to be able to watch him. And he wasn't a guy that took you by the hand and said, this is this, this is that, this is this. He wanted you to figure it out. He wanted you to think. He understood you'd make mistakes. And, you know, you'd hear about it when you made a mistake. But by the same token, you know, you learned a lot. And he would show you things. And once in a while, he would say, you know, you see that? And they say, yeah. And you know why that is? And like, no. And he would say, you know, it's because of this or because of that. And I always thought this or I always thought that. But most of the time, you really learn from watching him and watching what he did and just the way of really training a horse like it needs, you know, like it wants to be trained. That's really kind of the thing. It's hard to explain, but tangibly saying, well, you know, we do this and we do that. But we had a filly. He ponied her for 2 weeks straight, and breezed her, an easy breeze. Ponied her two more weeks straight and ran her in a graded stake race. And I said, I don't know anybody who would do something like that. And the horse ran far better than she had run. And that, I think that is the other thing, is his ability to understand that he had this whole saying, you say, you know, just because you have a plan doesn't mean it's the right one. And the ability to adjust, to adapt, to say to yourself, you know, the horse may not be running, you know, up to par, and that may not necessarily be the horse's fault. It might be mine. It might, you know, I might be training him too hard or too light or whatever. And I think that's why he's had so much success with horses that, you know, wouldn't be considered book one Keeneland type horses, or you know, they're homebreds you know, kind of rougher, you know, rough around the edge horses, or horses that didn't quite have the pedigrees that, you know, he's able to maximize the talent out of that. And you know, we've tried to do that on our own scale, you know, with my own stable, in that, you know, I don't really get any horses that are any good. Now, at least now, you know, we train, and that's not a complaint, but it's just what it is. And I mean, I you know, the places I train now, we just look for horses to fit there, and you try to find a horse that maybe a bigger outfit, you know, kind of fell through the cracks, or a horse maybe that's just going to get better as they get older, or maybe a horse that maybe just needs to be, you know, trained in a little different manner. And, but, you know, I really have to give Alan a lot of credit for a lot of my success, because a lot of the things that I've done have come, you know, directly out of his, you know, directly out of experiences I learned from him.
Visiting with trainer Chuck Simon on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Chuck, you've had tremendous success pretty much everywhere that you've raced. Talk about some of your best training jobs, and it not necessarily has to be a famous horse, but just horses that you've trained that you know you did a really good job with.
Well, there's one horse in particular that was always a favorite of mine, and he was a challenge at the train. He was very, very difficult. The horse named Strength and Honor, and we got him as a two-year-old turning three. He had it coming off a chip surgery in his knees. Another trainer had him. And a good trainer, too. It wasn't a trainer that wasn't a good trainer. But the owner, Kim Shifty, who's a good friend, and her dad had bred the horse, and he had the horse in training, and the horse had some issues, and he decided that he was going to, you know, let Kim have the horse, and she sent the horse to me. I was very fortunate to get the horse, but when I got him, he had been, like I said, coming off surgery and hadn't done that much training, and he was a Carson City. He was very, very, very fast, but he was the most stubborn horse you ever want to meet. He just wanted to do what he wanted to do, and he just did not care about the rider or about the person walking him or about, you know, anyone. He just had pretty much disdain for people, and you know, we kind of figured him out, and we gelded him, which, you know, you hate to do that with a horse, a well-bred horse of promise, but he'd never amounted to a hill of beans had we not. And we got him right, and he was a horse that needed to work fast, because I tried to slow him down, and it just didn't work. Okay? He just absolutely didn't want it. He'd sulk. So, you know, I just come up with a plan. I said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to let him train hard, and we're just going to work on him, work on his knees, and work on him, and put him in ice, and do all these things. And he wound up, I think he wound up making $400,000 or $500,000. He won, I think, 8 of 20 races. He won the overnight stake at Churchill a couple times. He ran at Keeneland. He won an allowance race here. He ran 114 buyer. But he was, you know, he had three throat surgeries along the way. He had another surgery, I think, on his hock. You know, so he was a horse that really had a lot of issues and was extremely, extremely hard to train. But my riders and my staff did a great job, and he used to love to kick the wall of the stall. So we went into the carpet store and got remnants and lined the stall with carpet wall on the stall, and then jammed straw in between to try to pad it, because we couldn't get him to stop kicking. So we figured we might as well just make it a little easier when he does do the kicking. And he used to also take he needed two ponies in the paddock to get the saddle on him. So he was quite a challenge, but he was a very, very successful horse, and he said he won almost half his starts, and it was always something new with him, and I really think that he was a horse that we had a lot of success with it that maybe somewhere else in another program, another barn, might not have been able to get to deal with all his idiosyncrasies.
Yeah, nearly $500,000 with a horse you have to keep in a padded cell. That's pretty good training job, I would say.
I tell you what, what was a great lesson, Jude, was you go to the sales and you're trying to buy horses, and you look at this horse, and he's a blocky kennel, but he was a little short, and he walked, his legs went everywhere when he walked, and I used to look at him. My office was right at the end of the shed row, and I'd see him walking by me every day, and I'd think to myself, you think you're smart. But here's a horse, he's about as fast as any horse in the country, and there's not a chance in the hell you would have paid, $1,000 for him at a horse. And no, nobody would have. But it just goes to show you that it's not just, ticking all the boxes, as they say, at the sale. It's a lot of times it's talent, and it's heart, and it's determination. And, that's part of the, that's the thing with the Alan Jerkins way is that, give them all a shot. Don't just throw them out because they're crooked or they do this or that. They all have some inherent talent. Some of them's talent level's lower than others, but you gotta, keep digging and maybe you'll find it. And that was certainly a horse that it did shine.
Chuck, only about 2 minutes left, believe it or not. It's kind of flown by here tonight on Trainer Talk, but want to give you an opportunity just for a couple of minutes to touch on a horse that I know is very special to you, and that is the horse that gave you your very first graded stakes win, Battle One, who won impressively at Churchill Downs that afternoon back in 2005. Talk about him for just a minute or two.
Yeah, he was a good horse. He was a good horse. He had talent, and he was relatively easy to train. He was pretty straightforward. He used to have his blood levels would get a little out of whack sometimes. He had some kind of kidney issue that we never really totally got resolved, considering he made $800,000 and won a bunch of races. But he was a good horse, and he was an honest horse. He tried hard, and he won. He ran on the dirt, he ran on the grass, and he won stakes on both. And that was a thrill, certainly winning that the Churchill Downs handicap on Derby Day. And I got to give Jay Mnuchin, the owner, a lot of credit, and he allowed us to take a shot in that race because we were prepping him for the turf race Derby Week, and he was training so good. And I said, let's take a shot at the $200,000 race. This horse is doing great, and he just he ran him off the feet that day. And that was great. And Ramon Dominguez, that was the first mount he'd ever rode for me. So that was kind of before he was a big star, but he rode him perfectly and certainly showed, he had what he was all about. I mean, he was a great rider.
And Chuck, one last thing very quickly before we let you go. Our good friend Joe Valente, Joey Diamond, as we call him with EPO Equine, one of the big sponsors of Trainer Talk here and big supporters of the network. And you have a horse in your care by the name of Oklahoma Den, who broke his maiden last time out. It's a great story. He's named after Joey's good friend, who they named Oklahoma Den, named the horse in his honor. Pretty cool story there as well.
It sure is. Oklahoma Den is one of the old throwback racetrack characters that loves the game. And he's got his handicapping theories, and he lives and dies. I mean, he'll bet anything. He'll bet trotters. He'll bet thoroughbreds. I'll bet he bet quarter horses. But just good people, and it was great that Oklahoma Den, the equine version, got its picture taken at Monmouth a couple weeks back. But yeah, those are good guys. Those are my Philly guys. They're different breed in Philly, that's for sure.
All right, Chuck, we do have to wrap up this edition of Trainer Talk, but want to thank you for being with us. We'll send you your gifts courtesy of EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those to you. And great to hear your story, my friend.
Thanks, guys. Good, looking forward to seeing you guys down here.
All right, Chuck Simon, Donnie K. Von Hemel in the first half of the program. If you missed it, a podcast will be available on our website, horseracingradio.net. Make sure you check it out. A lot of fun, JT.
Yep, absolutely. Could have gone another hour.
For Lee Delapina, our producer, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pena. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.